Welcome to Voices of Experience radio show and podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the Voices of Experience podcast wherever you find your favorite podcasts. No promotional fees have been paid to anyone appearing on Voices of Experience. Now, on with the show.
Well, Eric, Paul Casey here, and I'm just interjecting here before we get into the whole show. I'm going to play an interview that I had with David Williams last summer, and he wrote a book about the Boeing company, particularly Bill Boeing.
I remember this interview. Yeah, and in light of all the stuff that we've seen in the news about Boeing since then, this will be cool to revisit. So good choice.
Precisely. Because we did discuss some of their problems when we had the interview, but again, they continue. And one of the things that I find interesting, the name of the book is William Boeing, Gift of Flight. I read it. It is incredible. I learned so many things about him I didn't know. But, you know, one of the things I find interesting is that from finding out about, you know, the background of him, he didn't make his money particularly running the Boeing company. That was not his intent. He made his money in mining. He lived in Minnesota. He moved west to Seattle. And when he came to town, he was one of the wealthiest men in Seattle then. And he started Boeing as a hobby. What I find interesting is that it ran that way because that was his love. And it wasn't a company that was so much high-minded in making money, I guess. And what comes to mind when I think about that, and I'm making a giant leap here, it could be way off base, but think of somebody like Bill Gates starting Microsoft. We all know that. But to a lot of people around the world, it's the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They know nothing about Microsoft. They just know this guy from there. That's kind of how Bill Boeing was too. And he had a lot of other interests. So fascinating interview. That's coming up with Dave Williams in just a few moments. Also want to let you know that the Tacoma Rainiers are opening up their season the weekend of March 29th and 30th. And as a part owner of the Rainiers, we're so excited that the Rainiers are going to be broadcasting their games this year on Kixi. And that is so cool. But in celebration of that, I have two box seats right behind home plate. I want to give those two seats away. And that would be to the first caller into this show today at 425-653-1166. The game is on Saturday night, March the 30th, 2024. First pitch, 6:05 p.m. So again, 425-653-1166. Leave your name and telephone number so I can call you back and arrange to have your tickets picked up at will call when you get them. Is that pretty clear, Eric? Did I cover that, do you think? Would you be going, oh, I get this?
I totally do get it. And I think that whoever wins these tickets should definitely bring their radio with them so they can listen in on 880KIXI to the game while they're at the game. How cool would that be?
Perfect. We haven't had that. You know, that's a good point, Eric. I'm trying to think the last time the Tacoma Rainiers had radio broadcast, and it's been a long, long time, at least 12, 15 years. So we were one of the final teams in the Pacific Coast League to get on the radio again back in Seattle. And I know they've been wanting to do it for a long time. And I'm so glad it's happening with Kixi.
Me too.
All right. So on with the show.
Welcome to Voices of Experience on Kixi AM 880, KKNW 1150 AM, and of course my podcast as well. My name is Paul Casey, your host, and just want to get this in at the beginning of the show because at the end we play the timeless classics, at least we are today, not the one-hit wonder. But I do want to let people know, listening to the podcast and listening to the KKNW version of the show, the song will start, but we only get into maybe 35 seconds of it, and then we have to cut it off. And that's because of copyright issues. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of the way it is. So I just want to alert people because sometimes I'll hear a song cut off. I'm like, oh, darn it. Why are you doing that? But you're probably still going, darn it, if you really like the song. Why are you doing that? But that's why we're doing that.
Now you know why.
Now you know why. So let's get to the program today. Eric and Eric.
Yeah.
Hi to both of you.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
My first interview today is going to be with a David Williams. And he just wrote a book about William Boeing. And the book is called The William Boeing Story. I really think you're going to enjoy it. I won't go into much detail because I'll give a longer introduction in just a few moments because he comes on. So we're going to get to that. And then you have a spotlight today, Eric. And,
yes, with Lori Hardy. And we're going to talk about her podcast, which really focuses on your second chapter in life. What, you know, what would you like to do, say, north of 50, if you wanted to change your direction? And so she talks to people that have overcome hardship, people that have just made 180s in their life and succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. So it's very inspirational.
Look forward to that. I have pollster Stuart Elway back today. Some shakeup in the expected gubernatorial race occurred in the last week, and that is Dave Reichert had entered the race. I didn't want to get into too much detail right now on this, but I did want to talk to Stu about what he thought about how this is going to change what we expected, and certainly it's going to do that. So we'll get to that in a few moments after the interview with Dave Williams. Myths and reality today for chiropractic care with Dr. Dan DeLucci. And I see a chiropractor. I think you've told me you have too. Have you, Eric, do you go to one?
I've been a couple times. I'm not a regular, but, okay. You know, occasionally.
So I felt that it's always good to talk to someone who, because there's, I think, some myths out there about it. I'll just keep it at that, and we'll hit that a little later in the show. Not a big, long segment, though. The timeless classic for today, this song was number one for 2 weeks in 1973, and some of the lyrics may give it away, trying to become a superstar, but he didn't get far.
There you go.
You got it? Do you have it?
I need some time. Eric's got it for sure.
This is one of those all-time classics, and I'm surprised that it wasn't number one longer than 2 weeks.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. It really hit at the right time. It felt right, and you're right. It's kind of that song you think would have lasted longer, but I think it's still standing the test of time.
Absolutely.
It's still being revered by many. So that's coming up at the end of the show. All right, so let's get on with the show, and we'll be back in just a moment. So David Williams, I caught up with him about a week ago, and he is the author of the William Boeing Story, A Gift of Flight. Some of the insights David Williams uncovered about Bill Boeing: he did not create the company for money. He already had a lot of money. And this is the first time the Boeing family gave an author unprecedented access to his archives. David was an individual who is now executive director of the Hydroplane and Race Boat Museum in Kent. He has written 10 books, 8 of them about hydroplane racing. So back to the book about William Boeing. It is full of bootleggers, kidnappers, and political run at his early aviation. Let's start right there. Now, Dave, the family of Bill Boeing allowed you essentially unfettered access to boxes of material that would shed light on this man. Question is, why did they choose you?
I often wonder that myself. It was a combination of the right person at the right time. Neither Bill Sr., the founder of the company, or his son, Bill Jr., were very open to the public spotlight. They tried to stay private. And that has a lot to do with sort of the run-in that Bill Sr. had with Franklin Roosevelt back during the Depression era. Grandchildren of Bill Sr. are the ones that are alive today. They felt that it was time for his father's, or for their grandfather's story to be told. So they were looking. Then at the same time, I had worked closely with the family, essentially kind of a sports action biography of a man named Miroslav Slovak. We knew him in Seattle as Myra Slovak. He drove hydroplanes. He drove the Miss Wahoo for Bill Boeing. And while researching that book, I arranged a family reunion, if you will, of all the Boeing grandkids and cousins. And we all got together and shared a lunch. and told stories about Myra Slovak. During that meeting, people began to look at the idea of maybe doing something about the founder of the company as well, about Bill Sr.
They thought you'd be fair.
Yes, they thought it would be fair.
How long did it take you to research and write this book?
The book project itself was a 4-year project.
Quite a project. Were there like not thousands of boxes, but a lot of boxes that were saved over the years?
A lot of Bill's stuff was kind of folded in a tri-fold and kept in bank safety deposit boxes.
So what did you uncover about Bill Boeing Sr. that we might not have known about before?
Well, quite a lot. From the negative side, or you may consider it negative at the time, Bill lived through the era of Prohibition, and Bill was not a supporter of Prohibition. Back then, the world seemed divided between wets and dries. The wets wanted to drink, and the dries wanted to outlaw alcohol. And Bill was definitely a wet, and he fought politically to overthrow Prohibition, but he also didn't pay much attention to Prohibition entertained and had parties and served alcohol and actually got involved in at least 2 run-ins with the federal agents over Prohibition. They declined to prosecute in 1 case, and he became a witness against a major bootlegger, and he was not terribly proud of that. He didn't want to be a witness, but he also didn't want to serve time for violating the Volstead Act. So that may not be viewed positively by people today. As far as things that we didn't know about Bill, the one thing that most people are surprised about, traditional Boeing story, is that he left the company in 1934 and he never looked back, when in fact he did return to the company, and he returned to the company during World War II, and he worked for 4 years, not drawing a salary, not owning a share of stock, not making a penny off of it, but working during the war years to make sure that the planes that bore his name, the B-17, the Boeing B-17 and the Boeing B-29, that those were all the best, highest quality planes that could be built.
I read something that he got his inspiration from the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition in 1909.
Yeah, partially. Opened in 1909, and the very first day it was open, there was a man named John Mars that had a powered dirigible. It was like a big balloon, and it had a propeller on one end. And that was the first powered manned flight that Bill had ever witnessed. Later that year, 10, he went down to an air show in Los Angeles that was the first international air show in the U.S. And there he saw some real airplanes, some airplanes with propellers and wings and passengers. And that's where he fell in love with the idea of airplanes. Something that most people don't realize is that Bill did not make his money with airplanes. Bill was very successful in mining and logging. When he moved to Seattle in 1908, he was already the wealthiest person in King County, and he hadn't even seen an airplane. He only began to dabble with airplanes as a hobby after he was already quite wealthy. Sort of, if you will, like, say, Jeff Bezos, who made his money at Amazon and then decides to play with spacecraft. You know, Bezos in the future may be remembered as someone who is very involved in space travel, but we know he certainly didn't make his money that way. Same thing with Bill. Bill made his money in mining and timber.
Wasn't the first plane that he built a seaplane?
Yeah, the first several planes that he built were seaplanes. But it makes a little bit of sense when you think about the era. Back then, there were no airports. So you either took off from a pasture or you put pontoons on the plane and you took off from the water. And frankly, there were more places where there was water to land on and take off from than there were unfenced pastures that were big enough to land an airplane. You know, the Wright brothers started with a plane taking off from sand dunes near the ocean. But once you came inland, once you got around cities and towns, it was awfully hard to find a place that was close to town, that was big enough to land a plane. But of course, lots of major cities grew up around water. So having a seaplane allowed you to operate from a city, from a municipality where there were people, and not have to find some big open stretch of empty field that was usually way outside of town.
Didn't he get a huge order in World War I from the U.S. Navy to build 50 planes? And were those seaplanes?
They were seaplanes. It was an order from the U.S. Navy to build trainers. And a couple of things. When World War I started, no one knew it was called World War I at the time. It was all the Great War. in Europe. People talked about the Great War. It didn't become World War II until the second one started. Bill built a plane that he wanted to use as a trainer, and he sent two copies of it to Pensacola, Florida for the Navy to test. He was very proud of the planes because they were very stable, very easy to fly. Bill thought they would make perfect trainers. And the Navy, you know, telegrammed back and said, "Great plane, sorry, we can't buy any." And Bill responded with, "Why? What's wrong? It's a great plane." And the Navy said, "Well, we've put our best pilots in them, and we've tried to get those pilots to get the planes to spin out of control. They won't spin, so we can't buy any." And Bill again was, "Well, why? I thought having a trainer that wouldn't spin would be a good thing." And the Navy finally responded saying, "Well, no, we need to teach our pilots how to recover from a spin. And if we train them to fly in planes that are impossible to spin, they will never have that experience. They won't know what causes a spin, and they won't know how to recover from a spin." So in order to finalize the sale, Bill actually had to have his engineers rebalance the plane so it would spin easily, and then the Navy would buy them so they could use the trained pilots how to spin and how to recover.
Boy, that logic doesn't make sense, but I don't know. I guess I'm not in the U.S. Navy or something like that. But anyhow, it worked out for him. So
it did work out. It worked out great.
Yeah, whatever the case was. And also, didn't he make a bid? Because then we're talking airmail was getting started.
Yes.
And didn't he get involved in that as well?
Yes. Airmail came along a little bit later in the late 20s. At the end of World War One, there were a lot of big Liberty, big V-12 Liberty engines left over from the war that hadn't gone into planes for the war. The U.S. Mail Department asked for bids on mail planes, but insisted that you had to use this Liberty engine, which was a water-cooled V-12 engine. Bill didn't think it made sense to carry around a radiator and water, so Bill found an air-cooled engine called a Pratt & Whitney Hornet, or Wasp, rather, and put these air-cooled engines in his airplane, and that allowed him to bid much lower on the airmail. As he said at the time, "I can bid lower because I'm just carrying letters. I'm not carrying water and radiators." So he underbid his competition by quite a bit, and he got the route from Chicago to San Francisco. And at that time, passenger travel was almost unheard of, and the only passenger travel that you could find in airplanes would be by hitching a ride on a mail plane. Well, with Bill's lighter planes, he was able to offer one or two spots on each one of his planes, and that's sort of how the airline business grew. It grew as sort of an offshoot of airmail. We don't think of it that way anymore, but that's how it started.
Didn't in like 1934, the United States government, it sounds like he's getting very successful now, but they accused Bill Boeing Sr. of monopolistic practices.
Well, he did have a run-in with the U.S. Senate, with Hugo Black, and with Franklin Roosevelt in 1934. And we use the phrase monopolistic, and that's what a lot of the textbooks say, because it's easier to explain. But that isn't really what had happened with Bill. Franklin Roosevelt was not the trust buster. It was Theodore Roosevelt was the trust buster who broke up monopolies. Franklin Roosevelt was really just angry that coming out of the Depression, that there were people that were incredibly wealthy and people that were poor. And the main problem that Roosevelt had with Boeing was that his company was making too much money. And he felt that he was making money off airmail and military contracts. So they didn't use an antitrust law. What they did is they used a law that said no company could own airmail delivery and bid on military contracts. So those three things caused the board of directors to have to break the company up into three separate companies. The airmail company that Boeing had founded, called Boeing Air Transport, that became United Airlines. The manufacturing arm of the company that made airplanes kept the name Boeing. And the manufacturing arm of the company that made engines and propellers became United Technologies. So those are still three great big giants in the industry, you know, United Technologies, United Airlines, and Boeing. But at one time, they were all the same company.
So it turns out maybe that was a good thing that happened then.
It was perhaps a good thing. It got Bill very angry. He quit the company.
Well, at least, you know, Franklin Roosevelt ended Prohibition so we could go have some drinks and,
that's right.
You know,
so he could go
calm
have,
himself down
he
a little
could
bit.
Go have a, that's exactly right. One of the things, however, that became very ironic is when World War II started and the U.S. military needed 11,000 B-17s eventually, Boeing wasn't big enough to handle that order, and the U.S. military didn't want one company in, you know, on the West Coast making all those bombers because they would be too vulnerable to an attack. So the government broke Boeing up in 1934. And then in 1941, when they wanted a bunch of airplanes, they had to take the Boeing B-17 and divide it between several manufacturers all over the country in order to get it built.
If this isn't enough, did I also read that he got involved with horse breeding?
When he left the airplane business, he did get quite involved with horse racing and horse breeding. That was a passion of his from early in life. If you start to research Bill Boeing and go back in old newspapers, the first mentions you ever find of his name in a newspaper are as his accomplishments as a horseman. In 1934, he got very involved in horse racing. He even had a horse in the Kentucky Derby. It got third place and didn't win. But then after he retired later in life, he bought a farm up sort of in the Fall City area, and he got involved in cattle breeding. So he was a man that had a lot of interest: mining, lumber, airplanes, racehorses, and cattle breeding. He did it all.
Well, he certainly did, didn't he? That was Dave Williams, and thank you for that interview. And he thinks that Boeing, I'm talking about Mr. Bill Boeing, would be furious at the company that bears his name today.
Mm.
He did not build Boeing for the money. He did not build and motivated by shareholder value. And he was motivated by trying to make the best product. So that was his assessment after going through all his archives. And he came up with that assessment that, again, he would not be happy with the developments of Boeing right now. And he said, we look back and think of Bill Boeing as an airplane guy, but as he said in the interview, he had the beginning in timber. He was a logger, a miner, a real estate developer, a yachtsman, and just much more. He just did many different things. Williams says that if history repeats itself in about 50 years, people will think, for example, he makes this analogy to Jeff Bezos we're thinking about today, and to keep this in perspective, that he will be known as a pioneer in commercial spaceflight when people look back, and they probably won't even recall his name as the starter of Amazon.
Mm.
And it's kind of like, did you know all of that about Bill Boeing?
Right, no.
He didn't make money at all in that. It was his hobby.
Yeah, crazy.
That's kind of what Jeff Bezos is doing now. It's not Amazon. That's a hobby. And he doesn't care about that making money there per se. He's putting everything into it because this is his real jewel of what he wants to accomplish
his
in
passion.
Life more. And I started thinking about Bill Gates, the same. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill Gates may, I'll bet there's a percentage of people with all his work in Africa and other countries have heard of the Bill Gates and Melinda Gates Foundation. They don't know nothing about him starting Microsoft.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of took out of that interview. I thought that was really a fascinating part of that. He concluded by saying he had a strong affection for the man the more he learned about him and delved into it. He didn't know much about him, but he said he really felt quite engaged. And he also said he was much cooler than he thought he was. So that was the William Boeing story, Gift of Flight. And I think it was a really interesting to talk to that man.
Great segment.
Yes. And again, he's, the head of the Museum of Hydroplanes down in Kent. I've never been down to it, but I want to go down and see that and see what he's doing down there. So, because we have an incredible history of the Gold Cup and the beginnings of there. And what prompted me to do this interview, I was at the Rotary Club. He talked about that only, about how hydroplane racing got started here. And there were so many things in that. I went, what? Really? The Gold Cup, when it started in the early 50s, and how that led to so much of this community, I had no idea.
How about a field trip, a Voices of Experience field trip down there to the museum? Maybe we could even broadcast from there.
Ooh.
Let's think about that. We'll take that
off air. I like that.
Live.
That's a good idea.
I've always wanted to go there. Never been there.
Eric, would you join us? I mean, Eric Ryder.
I definitely would if I didn't have to be here running the board.
You would. You have to be doing it here. All right. Let's
look into that.
About that.
When a flock of geese knocked out two engines on U.S. Airways Flight 1549 right after takeoff from LaGuardia Airport, who would you want in the cockpit? Captain Sully or a pilot on their maiden flight?
If Captain Sully was your choice, then experience is important to you. And that's what Voices of Experience with Paul Casey is all about. People with experience in their chosen fields. A variety of topics are explored, including local and national public affairs, self-employment, travel, lifestyles, health and fitness, history, and adventure.
Welcome to this edition to Voices of Experience. My name is Paul Casey.
Now, Voices of Experience is simulcast on AM 880 KIXI and 1150 AM KKNW on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Voices of Experience is also rebroadcast on KIXI Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. Visit voicesofexperience.com and take a five-minute self-employment quiz. The higher you score on the quiz, the higher your prospects for success. That's voicesofexperience.com.
You never know whom you'll run into at the grocery store. You never know whom you're going to see or run into when you're doing the most mundane of activities. This past summer was an excellent example of that. Let me set the stage for you. At about midday, I was shopping for food in the local Stop and Shop grocery store. It is the only grocery store in Edgartown, Massachusetts, on Martha's Vineyard. I had been given a grocery list of what to get. It included Worcestershire sauce, fresh basil, eggplant, whole milk, heavy cream, eggs, marinara sauce, mozzarella balls of cheese, sour cream, and panko breadcrumbs. I had ridden to the market on my bike, hoping to be able to fit all of these items into the basket. As I'm looking for eggplant, I notice a man with white hair shopping right next to me. I say to myself, boy, he looks like Ted Danson. But I keep searching for the items on my list. I was not sure that it was he, but the resemblance was uncanny. A few minutes later, I see him again as we're both rummaging around in the vegetable and fruit section of the store. This time, I said to myself, that has to be Ted Danson. So what do? I call out to him saying, Ted Danson. The man responds to me by saying, yes. And then I stick out my hand and say, I'm Neil Peterson. And we shake hands. What then, you may ask? I then proceed to say to him, my favorite television show of all time was Cheers. And I just want to thank you for the role you played in that show. Thank you so much. Ted responded by saying thank you back to me. I could tell that he wasn't put off by my calling him out. I could tell that he was comfortable in his own skin. He was casual, warm, and friendly. It was a nice exchange. A little later, I was going for the checkout line when I realized that Ted Danson was going for the same checkout line. So I gestured to him with my left arm, asking him to go first, and added verbally, after you. Once again, he smiled and thanked me again. While he was unloading his items onto the conveyor belt for checkout, we strike up another conversation. This time it was about the vineyard, whether he was a regular here or just visiting. He told me that he comes here all the time and he'll be staying until August 1st this past summer because he had to leave for some work at that time. I tell him about my family's history on Chappaquiddick and how I now bring my kids and grandchildren here for 2 weeks in late June every year. He says that the vineyard is something special, and we both agree. I know it may sound corny, but it just thrilled me to meet and talk with Ted Danson. As brief as the encounter was, I got the sense that he was a nice human being. And it gave me the opportunity to express gratitude to him for the joy that he's brought into my life. Since this happened, I've done some research on Ted Danson, and I've learned quite a bit. At 75 years of age, he has a long and distinguished acting career that includes much more than Cheers. However, Cheers is what put Ted Danson on the map. Playing Sam Malone, the bartender owner of the bar Cheers in Boston, he won 2 Emmys and 2 Golden Globes. The show ran for 11 seasons and 275 episodes and was ranked by TV Guide as the 18th most popular TV show of all time. It finally stopped running because Ted wanted to do other acting roles. And he surely has done that. He's acted in 31 movies over the last 40 years. He's been nominated for over 42 awards, and he's won 7. In television alone, over the last 50 years, he's appeared in 60 series, films, or shows, Cheers being just one. More recently, he starred in The Good Place and Mr. Mayor. He's been married for almost 30 years to his current wife, Mary Steenburgen, an Oscar winner in her own right. He had two previous marriages and had a reported affair with Whoopi Goldberg years ago. Financially, he's successful with an estimated net worth of $80 million. He was paid $500,000 for each episode of Cheers, which ran for 11 seasons. He and his wife have a home on Martha's Vineyard, and he's very interested in the environment, especially ocean conservation. He has co-authored a book entitled Oceana, Our Endangered Oceans, and What We Can Do to Save Them. Apparently, he's still working. And as I found out, he goes to the grocery store to buy food, just like the rest of us.
Be sure to subscribe to Meandering Musings wherever you get your favorite podcasts. For more about Neil Peterson and to read more Meandering Musings and travel essays, visit meanderingmusings.net. Like the podcast? Please help us grow our listenership. Tell your friends about Meandering Musings and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Now, Stu Elway, this is a recording I had with him just earlier in the week, and he's been analyzing public opinion since 1975 and directing research projects across the country for large and small businesses. In 2016, Stu was rated by 538 Pollster, and that's the gold standard of rating, got an A-plus with his company. So that just shows how high esteem he's held. That's why I always like to go to him and talk about things that are occurring. So here we go. Dave Reichert announced that he's going to run for governor. The discussion I had with Stu Elway.
Since the 2000 election, Republicans have averaged 44% of the primary vote, and Democrats 53%. Simi Bird, the other Republican candidate, getting 10%. So let's say he gets a little bit more and Reichert gets the rest. That puts Reichert in 30 to 35% of the vote in the primary, which is certainly going to get him through. The interesting things on the Democrat side, there's three candidates over there. And Mullett was expected to get a substantial support from business and other traditionally Republican constituencies. But Reichert's entrance into that race expected to keep the Republican supporters at home, and it really cuts off the path that Mullett had to get through.
Yeah, so this may have hurt him more than anybody.
Probably. But you look at that side, too. Look at that same average over the last 20 years. In the primary, Democrat candidates have averaged a total of 53% of the vote. The one poll we have, Ferguson had 25% in the poll, leading France and Mullett, both in single digits. So take the average of 53. Give Ferguson that 25, that leaves 28% of the Democrat vote left, which means that a challenger would have to get virtually all of that to get by Ferguson in the primary or win some Republican voters, which is less likely now that a named candidate, Reichert, is on the Republican side.
Yeah, it seems like Raul Garcia heeded those words and dropped out. Kind of from what you're saying, there was no real pathway to win.
There was a path for Garcia to get into the primary, through the primary. And it's the same dynamic with three candidates carving up 53% of the vote. And one candidate already has half of that, that being Ferguson. And this average of 44% of Republican voters in the primary, Garcia had a path to get through the primary. And then who knows?
That door has been shut, essentially, now.
That door, he shut it.
The bottom line is that I will bet all of my cryptocurrency profits I've made, and I will bet that it's going to be Bob Ferguson and Dave Reichert, and that's pretty much in the bag. As much as you can say about politics, it's early, but seriously, could anybody really penetrate that? Ferguson, as far as I can see, he's going to be a tenacious campaigner, and he works hard, and he's got a huge fundraising advantage, so he's in. Now, well, as you pointed out, with the top two primary and Reichard, where he's at name recognition, 35%, I don't see how it could go any other way.
That'd be a good bet. As we say, it's a year away. Ferguson is probably, on the Democratic side, he's the most polarizing candidate. He's the least popular candidate among traditional Republican voters. And that was one of the reasons why Mullett was looking for support from business community and some other traditional Republican constituencies. If you're right, you bet pays off, and it's Ferguson and Reichert, you look for a pretty polarized electorate.
Well, that's never happened in this state. It'll be interesting to see
no,
that.
No, yeah.
This will be a first.
Right.
Now, and the other just quick question here, Stu, before I let you go, and that is, you're looking at the party being run by, you know, the extreme part of the party for the Republicans, and then you look now at having a more moderate candidate coming up, but for example, he has some appeal to people. He's not as scary as other candidates they've had because he's been pro-environment. I'm talking about Dave Reichert now.
Right.
He also was one of the only Republicans that voted to appeal that don't ask, don't tell policy, which angered some people on his side of the party. So he has some of that there, but still, you know, you look at his voted to defund Planned Parenthood. He's, from what I understand, he's not pro-choice. So ultimately then, giving those two, I guess, deficits and big ones, that if you're in a state like we are, how can he have any pathway to victory if he does win the Republican primary anyhow?
Well, abortion won't be the only issue, but the Democrats certainly try to hang that on him. And, you know, he's going to be a Republican, so he's going to have to answer questions about Trump, particularly if Trump is the nominee. So it is a difficult road for any Republican.
So there you have it again, as it's been going on since 1984. Going to be difficult for a Republican to win. But I think the person that got hit the most was Mark Mullett, and he's a Democrat because, let me go with my thought here, is that Ferguson is light years away in terms of the vote count now, the popularity, like 25%, I think Stu said. And for him to close that gap, what he was doing was appealing to the business community, and he was getting some traction there from some Republicans because Ferguson, while he's very popular, he doesn't really trend well with business people in the state. So he could have made some inroads. But with Reichert coming in, those Republicans are going to go back.
Sure.
So that really, I think, hurt the Democrat, Mark Mullett, the most, in my assessment. And then Raul Garcia drops out, but he announced he's going to run against Maria Cantwell when she runs. I don't know when that is. So anyhow.
Can there be a third candidate in the gubernatorial race?
We have top two president or primary in this state. So it could be two Democrats running against each other. It's the top voters. We're, I think, one of five states in the country that have it that way.
That'd be interesting.
So, and that's happened before. So from politics to some fun facts.
Fun facts.
Yes. And Turianne Jackson sent me these. She sends all these cool little things that I don't see anywhere else from the L.A. area, and the wife of former broadcaster Keith Jackson.
Okay.
Anyhow, having said that, here it is. Fun facts. More people live in New York City than in 40 out of 50 states in this country. The word Pennsylvania is misspelled on the Liberty Bell.
Did not know that.
I thought I'd heard that before. It would take more than 400 years to spend a night in all of the Las Vegas hotel rooms. Over 400 years.
And a lot of money.
There is enough concrete in the Hoover Dam to build a two-lane highway from San Francisco to New York City.
Wow.
Boston has the worst drivers in the nation of the 200 largest cities. Kansas City has the best drivers. And I've driven in Boston. It's the worst city I've ever driven in. I haven't driven in all the cities, but it is by far the worst city that Ira drove in. As a matter of fact, I remember I was driving with Marty, my wife, and I was in the middle of the street, and I said, there was a red light, I'm out. I jumped out of the driver's seat. You drive. We went around the other side, and she got in and drove. I'd had it. I just thought about that.
So
right
what was
now.
It? That were they just aggressive drivers
yes.
or terrible streets?
Absolutely. Okay. So anyhow, that's some of the fun facts for today. So we'll be coming back. Well, hey, you're going to have your interview coming up right now with Lori Hardy. So anxious to hear that.
Sounds great. Well, I want to welcome a special guest here to Spotlight on Success. I have in studio with me in person. Love it. Lori Hardy, how you doing?
Hi. Yeah, good.
We work together, but you also do so much. You know, you've heard that term side. What is that? Side hustle?
Mm-hmm.
I think you must have five.
Maybe.
It's okay. And you succeed at them all. I love your latest podcast. And I wanted to talk about it because on this show in the past, we've talked about kind of reinventing yourself. And what do you do maybe after retirement, let's say? What are some tips and things like that? So just the mere fact that your podcast is interrupted, Act Two, Reinventing Your Legacy, that drew my attention. So let's talk about the title, how you came up with it, and what the podcast is all about.
So many people are not able to retire anymore.
Yeah, I'm raising my hand.
Yeah. We had the 2008 thing. We've had COVID. The rug has been pulled out from under so many people. What I have seen is some people are just like deer in the headlight. They don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Some people are like, I am going to use my gifts and talents and all of my experience of all of my years and do something. I just put out a thing on my Facebook and I said, hey, if you have recreated your life in your 50s or 60s and want to talk about it, let me know. And so many people have signed up for an interview. And the theme I'm seeing, men as well as women, but okay. The theme that I'm seeing is when the carpet got pulled out, when they either got really sick or they got COVID or they got laid off, they had to find some self-love. They had to find a way to put themselves first because it's a generation where they have just worked and worked and worked and put everybody first. This is the theme of the people that I'm interviewing. And once they found self-love, they found what they loved. And now they're living these lives doing these things that they absolutely love that they couldn't have given themselves permission to do before.
That's really interesting. Some of the people you interview, or maybe most of them, spent a career, let's say, working in a sense for their family or working for the household or working for retirement funds. And suddenly they might have the opportunity to do something for themselves.
Exactly. I'm a life coach. One of my hustles. A lot of people will stay in a job because they need the insurance or they have this feeling, I can't just quit my job. They don't really understand you can transition into another industry. People don't want to take a pay cut. But often we see people staying in jobs they hate. And guess what happens? Their health deteriorates. I'm hoping with this podcast that people will recognize there's hope and that maybe something they do that they think everybody can do, they'll recognize maybe it's something that's unique in them and they can use it to share their story and help other people.
Well, that's wonderful. I wonder, too, have you talked to people who have discovered that maybe they don't need to make a major change? Maybe it's just a smaller change that was sort of in front of them all the time.
Yes. In fact, the one lady I just spoke with, she's doing the same thing, only she's doing it on her terms.
Okay.
So she worked in marketing and she was really good at a lot of things and they kept asking more of her. Our generation, the older generation, will do more. The new generation is quiet quitting. They're like, oh yeah, I'll do it, but they won't. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
Yeah. Our generation, the boomers, who this is kind of about, it's like, okay, now take that energy and do it for yourself and create your own business where you can help the people you want to help. And somebody said on one of the interviews, I shouldn't be working for the man. I should be working for myself.
You're a veteran of radio. You've done all sorts of things on radio. You're now also a life coach, which is amazing. We had a chance to chat about that a while back, and it's a fascinating part of your business. As we talk about just audio, podcasts are really interesting because the demographics can be from young to more senior. You see that demographic across, depending on the subject matter, what they want to listen to. So I kind of find it interesting that you got boomers listening to it, but you also have Gen Zs listening to podcasts. Talk about the power of podcasting.
It really is interesting because you can listen while you're doing things, so you can multitask. Whereas with YouTube, you almost have to stop and watch. the thing that I love about podcasting, and I teach it, is if you speak in a certain way, you can get people to lean in. I noticed a lot of podcasters are talking in a way that, because they don't understand the power of radio, I'll just say radio because it's audio. Mm-hmm. We don't talk to the masses. None of us in the business, we always talk to one person. And that's the magic. And when people understand that, there's something just very intimate about a podcast when you feel like you're the only one they're talking to. And so I do traffic reporting, and my whole goal in is that I ask a question. Are you on 405 at 520? I want people to say out loud, yes. But if I say, hey, you guys, there's something going on, people aren't going to take it personal. But if I ask a question and I make them feel like they're the only one, they're going to answer me yes or no. And I feel like that engages people and it makes them feel seen and heard. And that's what people are lonely right now.
They are. And that's one of the things I liked about your podcast is the way that you speak to the person you're interviewing. If you were to have a pie chart, I was thinking about this as I was listening to your last podcast, it would seem that 90% of it would be filled with your guests' comments and replies to what you'd ask. I certainly fall victim to this where I just talk too much. So I'm going to stop right now and just ask you, how do you do that? You do a wonderful job at it. And why is it so important?
It is so important because their story is important. It's not about me, even though it's my podcast. And what I have learned, good interviewers will ask a question, even if they sound really dumb. I think sometimes we're afraid of sounding dumb, so we keep qualifying our question. Mm-hmm. But to ask a question, plus we're also afraid of dead air. And in a podcast, you can edit that out. But to ask the question and then trust that that person, A, will ask a question if they don't understand it, or B, hopefully it's open-ended enough that it'll help them say things they never thought they would say.
Let's talk about some practical things that people can do in their own lives if they're facing this situation in their life with, like, you know what? I've done the things I've had to do. Now I want to do the things I want to do. Well, how do you get started?
I would say hire a coach, because what people don't know about coaches is it's all about you. So when you come in, the coach doesn't have an agenda unless they're a consultant. If you are getting like a small business coach and you want to start a business, they're going to tell you how to do it. But if you're trying to find what it is you love, get a coach that will listen and hear your heart and help you connect the dots. And you might be amazed at what you already know you know.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, too, that these are kind of exciting times to have these options. For a lot of us, it's not the days of I worked 40 years, got my pension, and now I'm going to sit or go play golf or whatever.
Right.
It's kind of exciting. I mean, even though, yeah, I am going to be working into my retirement, it's kind of exciting to think of the options.
It is. And we have so many. I remember when I wanted to get back in radio, I could barely record anything because we didn't have the ability at home. Mm. Now we can record. We can share our legacy. And that's what I'm really all about is record YouTube, whatever, even if you save it to your phone, because our kids really don't know everything about us. We may think we shared everything, but they don't know. So if we just take the time, tell one story, save it on your phone, do one video, save it on your phone, whether you ever put it anywhere, it'll be found one day and you'll leave a legacy that maybe somebody didn't know that about you.
Even though you're just starting this new podcast, you've been on other podcasts and you're a major part of others. What is there now, six? In the can now, as they say, I guess. And of course, more each and every month are going to be added. We're talking to Lori Hardy, and her podcast is Interrupted, Act 2, Reinventing Your Legacy. And I have to tell you that the scope and breadth of your guests are amazing. You really talk to different people, but there is a common theme, isn't there?
Yeah, there really is. And it's reinventing themselves and what it takes to do that.
Just give it a listen, folks. You'll be hooked. You'll be subscribing. I've already listened. I just found out about it myself, and I've already listened to two, and I'm on my third because Lori does a great job. Lori, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. And join us next time for an edition of Spotlight on Success, and check out the podcast Interrupted, Act 2, Reinventing Your Legacy. If you're sort of facing that in your life, regardless of your age, I think you're going to get something from it. Check it out.
Quote of the week. I believe in those who take the next step as opposed to those focused on the 200th step. Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. Timeless classic coming up in just a moment.
The singer of this week's Timeless Classic said that she hoped it would comfort the many thousands of people when they realized their dream of being in motion pictures, television, or music, but then failed to realize their dream and plunge into despair. The song soared to number one. James Weatherly wrote the song, but said he was looking for a title. He was calling his friend Lee Majors one night, and Farrah Fawcett answered the phone. He asked what she was up to. Farrah said she was taking a midnight plane to Houston. Weatherly found the name of his song that night, but it ended up being changed just before it was recorded. From October 27, 1973, Gladys Knight and the Pips, and Midnight Train to Georgia.
He's leaving the life he's come to know. Ooh.
He said he's going.
He said he's going back to find.
Going back to find.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. What's left of his world? The world he left behind. Not so long. Then